It will be impossible to give many details of the life of Frank Lloyd Wright if I am to talk about his architecture. He has lived richly and colorfully. Tragedy has visited him, and acclaim has surrounded him. But you can read the story yourself as Wright tells it in his autobiography, and I suspect that once you begin it, you will have difficulty laying it aside. Wright was born in Richland Center, Wisconsin, the son of a Baptist clergyman who was deeply interested in Bach and Beethoven as well as in theology. Perhaps he saw a connection between them. In any event, music was an important part of the young boy's background. Soon a call to another pastorate took the family to Weymouth, Massachusetts, where they remained during Frank's childhood. At about 1880, when he was 11, the family returned to Wisconsin to settle in the capital, Madison. When Frank was ready for college, it was convenient for him to attend the University of Wisconsin right there in Madison. He studied engineering, there being no architectural course. In his spare time, he worked for Dean Conover, who was also superintendent of buildings for the university. In Frank's last year, however, worried over the sacrifices his mother was making to keep him in college, he decided to forego his degree and start his architectural career at once. So in the spring of 1887, found him in Chicago, first in Silsby's office and then in the office of Adler and Sullivan. I told you of Sullivan's importance in an earlier talk. Wright could not have entered an environment more stimulating to him than the office of Adler and Sullivan. For 6 years directly, and for many more years indirectly, Sullivan contributed to the development of Wright's creative ability and, as Hitchcock suggests, was probably himself influenced by Wright. Since the firm was too busy to bother with houses, it fell to Wright to do all residential commissions. Before he left the firm in 1894, he had built over 15 houses. In these houses and in the ones that followed, Wright's originality is clearly expressed. Whereas most houses of that time were vertical, Wright's were horizontal. And whereas most architects depended upon the historical styles, Wright's houses are practically free of stylistic influence. Not that they have no style about them, but their style is Wright's own creation. Many of the houses built in the years around 1900 still seem modern, and especially so in comparison with their stylistic neighbors. In 1904, Wright built his first outstanding work in industrial architecture, the administration building for the Larkin Soap Factory. This was an attempt to create a pleasant, cheerful workplace in the midst of smoke, noise, and dirt of the factory district of Buffalo. Brick was used on both exterior and interior, a brick chosen for its resistance to dirt. The interior consists of a single large room with floors as galleries opening onto the central court, which is top-lighted. All windows are located 7 feet above floor levels and the space beneath used for filing. Desks and other office furniture were designed by Wright with special attention to ease of cleaning. The structure is fireproof and is practically sealed against dirt, noise, and odors. Fresh air is brought in through shafts extending above the roof surfaces. Those are in the four corners of the building. When I visited the building a few years ago, it still seemed admirably suited to its purpose, although that purpose has now changed to merchandising rather than administration. 1910 and 1911 saw the publication of Wright's work in Europe, and through this he became a source of direct inspiration to many of the present European modernists. During the years of the First World War, the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo was his most important work. In this, he employed a unique system of construction. Here, he was building in an earthquake center. He studied the nature of earthquakes. He found that they were wave movements of earth accompanied by terrific shocks. Deep foundations with long piles wouldn't do. They would isolate and rock the building. Much better short or shallow foundations. Under the surface soil lay 60 or 70 feet of soft mud. Why not float the building on that mud? He did. Furthermore, he combined lightness with tenuity and flexibility. Instead of running floors from wall to wall with ends supported on the walls, Wright made the floors with a central dividing line or separation. Thus, when they were like the floor, each section of floor was like a tray carried upon a waiter's upraised hand, except that these floors were rigidly attached Under earthquake conditions, such a floor would not crash down upon the heads of the occupants, but separate and move up or down with the wall to which it was attached. Instead of heavy, murderous roof tiles, a light, handwork green copper roof was specified. To ensure a supply of water in case the water mains were broken by the earthquake, as they usually are, a great reservoir or pool was incorporated in the entrance court, an architectural feature, but utilitarian as well, for it was connected to the water system of the hotel and conserved the roof water. The difficulties encountered in construction were tremendous. Financial difficulties were added to these, but finally the structure was complete, and Wright returned to Los Angeles. 2 years later, in 1923, news of the terrible earthquake which wiped out much of Tokyo and Yokohama was shouted in the streets. 10 days of uncertainty followed a preliminary notice that the hotel had been destroyed. Then came a telegram from Baron Okura saying, "Today, hotel stands undamaged as monument of your genius. Hundreds of homeless provided by perfectly maintained service. Congratulations, Okura." Wright's 4-year struggle was vindicated. During the 1920s, Wright built a number of houses and designed many projects which did not come to fruition. His exhibition, prepared for the Chicago Art Institute in 1930, circulated both at home and abroad. Wright was considered by many as an old master, but those who thought of him as such overlooked his amazing creative vitality. Since 1930, Wright has added accomplishment to accomplishment. In 1929, Wright was preparing a scheme for adapting the old Hillside Home Schools building near Madison to the purposes of a school of allied arts, with a view to the establishment of the Taliesin Fellowship. Work was begun on this project in 1933 and has progressed at intervals since that year. An increasing number of commissions since 1935 has slowed work on the fellowship buildings, and I believe that there is still much to be done. Another project which has received much of Wright's attention, together with that of his student apprentices, is Broadacre City. This is an effort to demonstrate the functional relationship of the elements which compose the average community, the balance between man and nature. It represents 4 square miles at a county seat and includes a great number of separate edifices of various types. Taliesin fellows made tiny models of these to the scale of the whole scheme. One part of the scheme was an ideal college, and this Wright has developed into the Florida Southern College at Lakeland, Florida. The site of the Florida Southern College is a large orange grove, sloping toward a lake. As usual, Wright took full advantage of the setting and linked his architecture to it. The plan is balanced but asymmetrical, with a chapel and library serving as nuclei. One of the noticeable and unusual features is the ample provision for parking and for direct approach to the open-air theater. The buildings are connected by walks which are covered for protection against the sun. The chapel is a highly remarkable building, based on a hexagonal plan and having a tower which contains both a carillon and flowers. One of Wright's most spectacular houses of recent years, and now it is almost 10 years old, is the Kaufman House at Bear Run in the Pennsylvania woods. Henry Russell Hitchcock, who has written frequently and well about Mr. Wright's work, sees in this house a combination of 2 sorts of romanticism, the romanticism about nature and the romanticism about scientific feats of construction. He says, "A house over a waterfall sounds like a poet's dream. A house cantilevered over a waterfall is rather the realized dream of an engineer. Through the forest trees, the long horizontals of slabs and parapets, the metal sash enclosing the rooms are hardly visible and offer no such sense of support as the wood and masonry mullions of the prairie houses." End of quotation. This house was intended not for week-in and week-out living, but rather as a weekend retreat. Consequently, Wright has used an openness of plan hitherto only possible to small houses. The Kaufman House, or Falling Water, as it is called, is anchored in the rock of the waterfall, and one is conscious of this while looking at the vertical stone wall which rises above the mass of the house as a sort of central core. From this central core, the living floors are projected horizontally with great overhanging balconies of reinforced concrete. The main floor consists almost entirely of one large room, with subordinate spaces opening off this. A suspended stair leads from this level down to the quiet water above the waterfall. The upper floors consist of individual suites, each opening upon its own terrace. From every point of view, the interweaving of verticals and horizontals, the advance and recession of space, and the variations of texture in the materials compel one's attention. Add to this the varied shadows cast by the surrounding trees, the reflection of the water and its music, and one is forced to admit that here is one of the most dramatic conceptions of our time. I said that in 1903, Wright created one of the significant examples of industrial architecture, that was the Larkin Building. Between 1936 and 39, he has created another significant example of this type in the Johnson Administration Building at Racine, Wisconsin. In this building, the workspace is contained in a large rectangle with a roof supported in a most unusual way. Tall mushroom columns, only 9 inches at the base, spread out at the top until they look like giant lily pads. These, with the glass of the interstices, constitute the roof of this remarkable interior. In a night view of the exterior, one can see this from above, and one can also see that the exterior walls are only screen walls, for at their tops, where a cornice would normally be, are horizontal bands of light shining through the glass tubing from the inside. Rising out of the mass of the building are two step-back cylindrical ventilators, nostrils, Wright calls them. Wherever solid material is used, that material is a beautifully finished red brick, laid up with raked joints, which emphasize the horizontal line. Corners are rounded. Everything is precise as a beautiful machine. And as in the Larkin Building, Wright designed the furniture for this Johnson Building and had it made out of steel and magnesite. Equally as interesting is Taliesin West, located about 23 miles from Phoenix, Arizona, and used by the Fellowship during the winter season. Here again, Wright has integrated his architecture so that it is in perfect accord with that western landscape. Above the battered, massive red stone walls rises a light, airy structure made of California redwood and canvas. The rich desert vegetation and the triangular reflecting pool form the only decorative accents outside of the construction itself. The simplicity of the structure is a demonstration of Wright's maxim, eliminate the unnecessary. Wright is now in his 8th decade, his 6th as an architect. Already he has given us more than any other single American architect, but he is perhaps busier now than at any other stage of his career. What new contributions will he make? I cannot answer, but I feel sure that they will be of lasting significance.